Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron Kiefer, and this is episode number 311. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment. Just helps us continue to highlight the great coaches that we have in our profession. Also want to thank our sponsor, Train Heroic, for bringing this episode to you for free. I only partner with companies that I believe in, both the people and the product, and Train Heroic has a fantastic product, but their people are even better. And if you're in the market, I would highly recommend, not just from a delivery system for your athletes, but also the entrepreneurial side of being able to put workouts up and make some side money as well. So I'd definitely check them out. If you're not, next time you see them at a clinic, just let them know how much you appreciate them being a part of the show. This week I'm joined by a buddy of mine, Matty J. He's the athletic performance coach at the Cronulla Sharks NRL team down in right outside of Sydney, Australia. And I got a chance to meet Matty, I don't know what it's been now, probably 4 or 5 years ago in Beijing was the first time we met. But he's just a great guy doing some fantastic things down there, man. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks, Mike. Appreciate the opportunity for a chat. It's
Matty, you've done a little bit of everything, man. You know, you've been a teacher. You've worked, overseas. You worked in the academy system. You're at the highest level in rugby, obviously. You know, which one of these experiences best defines you as a coach?
Oh, yeah, as you said, I've had a few experiences, Ron, and pretty lucky, had some great, I guess, experiences with each of them. And, reflecting on China, as you mentioned, I was over there before, great personal and professional growth, without a doubt, over there. But I guess the biggest impact on my coaching career was my time as a teacher, both actually teaching and the time I spent at university undertaking the degree. It significantly shaped how I approach a lot of the situations that you encounter in professional sport, and forever grateful that I got some really good advice early on in my exercise science degree to switch over to physical education teaching.
Yeah, so, I think go ahead.
I was just going to say, for me, really digging into it, the pedagogy of teaching and coaching for me is one in the same, and where it's not, it's very similar. So, the skills that I was able to learn as a teacher, serve me every day as a coach.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think the great coaches are great teachers, and I think great teachers are great storytellers. And if you can do all three of those things, you're at the highest level. And I think that's no coincidence where you are where you are. I don't go too much into these shows without asking the question that is my favorite question on the podcast is, mistakes. I think we are a product of the mistakes that we make. And, I think I like to ask the question about, the biggest mistake you've made and how you've learned from it. Because if you can help another coach, maybe side swipe that mistake, hopefully they get they break a few less legs along the way. So what's the biggest mistake you've ever made as a coach and how you've learned from it?
Yeah, well, for me, Ron, again, with failure, it's only failure if you don't learn from it and if you do it twice. So like most of us, probably failing every day and learning from that. But reflecting back on the biggest one that's probably shaped what I do now, I'll have to go back to teaching, Ron. And that was, to set the scene, it was my first year of teaching, and I still remember it because I share this with interns and I guess give them some context about, preparation and understanding your content knowledge. But first year of teaching and had a year 10 class. So year 10 are notorious for being that year that's disengaged with learning. And there's a number of reasons why, and it's not every student, but year 10 is that transitional year between junior school and senior school. The kids are becoming you know, more socially engaged, you know, parties and relationships and all that's going on outside. You've got, you know, hormones and the behavioural changes that happen during that period of time, 15 and 16. So, you know, your back's up against the wall before you've even entered the classroom. So for me, you've got to have a, you know, engaging content. You've got to make it relevant and purposeful to the group in front of you. But first year of teaching, I just didn't have that skill set, Ron. And I'd arrive to a class 2 to 3 minutes earlier to greet the kids because that had set the tone of the lesson. If you set the tone of the lesson, how you start the lesson generally is much smoother. But for some reason, I can't remember, I arrived late, 2 to 3 minutes late, got to the front of the room and the kids were a little bit disheveled. You know, the naughtier kids were mucking up a little bit. And I had to resort to, I guess, classroom management and behavioural management from the get-go. And I was always of the opinion that I never wanted to have to manage a class through behavioural management. I always wanted the content and my communication style and my engagement with the class to be the management tool itself. But got the kids inside, calmed them down, and then once I got into the lesson, I realised I hadn't prepared enough and my content wasn't appropriate to the group in front of me. And at that time, I didn't know my content area well enough to talk to it, to tell stories, as you mentioned before. So the lesson just progressively got worse. And it, as I said about classroom behavioural management, it shifted to that. And that just, for me, that takes away from that educational, you know, purpose of the lesson. So all I was doing was managing behaviours. Everyone walked out of the room disappointed. Naughty kids, you know, were naughty and they probably went on to their next lesson and I interrupted or I slowed the progress of the next lesson because those kids were highly agitated. I was upset. I didn't meet the outcomes of the class. And I walked out and said, I'm never gonna let that happen again. So from that point on in time, I always was prepared. I made sure I had my content. I could speak to my content. I used to do a thing where, and one of my colleagues at the time used to call it a chicken wing, Ron. It was, you'd go in and you'd wing the lesson. You had to be able to talk the whole lesson to the content without any resources.
Right.
And that was something that, you know, I bring to coaching now. That's something that I tell our interns now, always be prepared, know your content, start the lesson or start the coaching session well. How you start the session will generally dictate the first 10 to 20 minutes. So if you're controlled, if you're calm, you've got clear expectations and guidelines, you set that out, everyone knows what's expected of them. And it's especially important with young kids. A lot of our interns coach the young kids within our academies.
Right.
So how you convey that information, your expectations at the start will generally go a long way to those kids and that session being successful. It's a little bit different with our elite guys, you know, that we still introduce every session, but, you know, when you're an elite athlete, you know what's expected of you to an extent, so you don't need the whole book thrown at you and the big discussion. But, yeah, that really, reflecting on that, that really changed my practice going forward, both as a coach and as a teacher, for sure.
I think it's so important. I mean, you know, I think the old adage goes, you know, genius isn't taking the complex and making it complex. It's taking the complex and making it simple. And when you're able to do that in a structured setting like that, so that you're able to teach it and deliver it in a way that people can understand, then it's a little bit easier to manage those behaviors that arise. That people management is one of the hardest things that anybody does, especially as a coach.
Yeah, and that's, for me, that's all teaching was. And I got some really good advice early on from one of my first mentors as a teacher. He said, always know 3 to 4 things about every student in your class, because then, you know, you've got that avenue for discussion. And I used to have a nice little activity I used to do for that in the classroom. But he also said, make sure you have really positive relationships with the naughty kids.
Yeah.
Okay. Because if you get them, and, you know, by naughty, I just mean the kids that, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
I think I probably had really good relationships with those kids, Ron, because I was one of them in the classroom as well. So I always knew what their next step was. But relationship with that kid. And then if they're walking into your class and, you know, engaged, they want to be there, they're having fun, then those classroom management issues that arise in other classes for that student doesn't happen. So there's no behavioural concerns, because sometimes it could be just one source that disrupts the whole lesson. So if you get on top of that through effective relationships and communication and engagement within the classroom, even within a coaching setting, then it's you know, a lot more successful, and you know, you achieve your outcomes that you set out, and everything's a lot smoother, which I always teach. I never wanted to, you know, I wasn't big on raising my voice. I just, you know, I wanted, you know, to be there and to achieve the outcomes of the lesson, and that never happens if you're raising your voice every 2 to 3 minutes to curtail behavior.
100%. Well, when we've both worked in China, we've both coached athletes in China, and so sometimes it's easier. Obviously, not only are you managing the content, the delivery, but then you go to a place like China where you don't speak the language, different culture, the whole deal. Talk a little bit about what you've learned from your experience coaching in other cultures that you've taken back to, you know, your native land, basically.
Yeah. Well, firstly, like, you know, reflecting back on China, we've got to understand that the Chinese system's successful. It's been successful for a long period of time. You know this, John, and us as Western coaches, sometimes we're being thrown into the mix where we're not actually wanted by the team sport coach.
Right.
We've just been thrown upon them by the bureaucrats. So, you know, you've got the issues that arise with that. So the building of trust, the communication, the sharing of information, the relationship forming. So that first little bit of creating those relationships and building trust, you know, it's something that's embedded in your practice from day one, but just understanding, I'd never really had that in an environment where my help or services hadn't been asked for. So it was a unique situation trying to actually navigate that and understand the landscape at first. So I was very lucky in that a couple of my athletes got some early success. So that got me the buy-in that I needed straight away. But conversations with other guys that were in my team, early success or opportunities for success didn't arise as quickly as mine did. And that process of trust, buy-in, communication was a lot harder. So just, again, not learning it from China, but reinforcing the importance of it. Having those positive relationships, sharing of information and building trust. I think trust with athletes comes pretty quickly over there, only because I think we can bring a more, I guess, relationship focus to the athlete coach.
Sure.
The Chinese haven't had before. They have very strong relationships with themselves, within their teams, but sometimes the relationship between coach and athlete is more distant, more authoritarian, and you know, something as simple as adding choice to a workout is something that maybe Chinese athletes have never had before, and at first can be quite taken aback from that. But giving them choice and allowing them, you know, a say over their programming, their processes, facilitated that trust and buy-in with those athletes very early. And I think just, you know, all coaches care, but, you know, the significant care that you can offer when you're working as part of a holistic team, when we're bringing in, you know, physios, missing, you know, injury concerns at the start of sessions and just stuff that they may not have been exposed to, builds that trust very, very quickly within the Chinese athlete.
Great.
And then digging into it further, Ron, like it's just that, you know, the transfer of information, those types of things, that it shows you the value and the importance of having everyone on board and the understanding of every component of a program. Early on, it was very hard to get, you know, simple things such as a weekly structure or training and a weekly program and then competition schedules and for what we do, we can still keep moving forward, but it's very hard to acquire your knowledge to the best of your ability without all the pieces of the information.
Right.
So that was something that, again, was reinforced in China, the value of, you know, everyone being on the same page, everyone working towards a common goal, and having an environment that drives that high expectations and high outcomes, and not having a siloed approach, which could, you know, was evident in China only because we were these outsiders coming into a system.
Yeah, I think, you know, I had a coach tell me once that, you know, you want me to love you, make sure you love my kids, you know, and I think that trust, you know, especially with coaches and people that maybe are a little skeptical of somebody new coming into the equation, you know, you just got to invest time and energy into those athletes and get them to really, like you said, buy in and show them that you're there for them, you know, they care about them as people before an athlete, and eventually you win that trust. You get the buy-in from the coach, and you're able to affect change. And that doesn't change whatever culture you go into. I think that's pretty universal throughout. You know, you're in a sport now, working rugby league. I mean, it's, you know, one of the most unique things to me. I mean, having worked in American football for most of my career is, I mean, the number of games, I think you said something about 22 games or something, right?
Yeah, we have a regular season around
test
24 games, and then a final series where you can play up about four games.
It's such a violent game, like American football, and obviously missing the pads, longer season. How do you prepare the athlete to be able to endure that kind of stress for that amount of time?
Ron, you know, as with everything, strength underpins resiliency. So everything's, you know, built from a foundation of strength, and then obviously we need the capacity to endure that strength throughout you know, a long season. When looking at, I guess, at the athlete across the course of the season, it's just understanding where they're at in terms of what needs to be achieved in regards to their load, positional requirements of load, and then monitoring and making sure we're getting the most appropriate dose across the season to keep that athlete achieving on the field. It's rugby league is you could positional specific roles do occur, but generally there's a lot less positional specific training as there would be in say as rugby union to a degree, and then obviously American football. So it's just having a holistic program where we're taking into account all elements of performance and making sure that, you know, each athlete is getting what they need relative to that point in time. And obviously we've got a number of, you know, outstanding measurables that we use to inform our practice. And at any given time, we feel we know what dosage we need to apply to an athlete to keep them moving, you know, moving the needle in the right direction.
You know, part of that equation is having and surrounding those athletes with a great team. And you guys are doing a pretty unique team experiment or team building activity as a staff. I think you're doing outrigger canoeing or something, right?
Yeah, you're right. We're still doing it at the moment, but last year we set ourselves a challenge to do the Molokai Ho. The Molokai Ho is the world championships of outrigger canoeing. So outrigger canoes are, I think it's a traditional Polynesian canoe. Big sport in Hawaii, Tahiti, and essentially six guys in a canoe. And we had to paddle from Molokai to Oahu in Hawaii. So about 70 kilometers and pretty much across. We had a discussion, put all our eggs in one basket, and said, "Hey, we're gonna train from in January through to the end of the season, and then get on a plane and fly over and challenge ourselves to play this race." So really good experience, Ron. Like everyone from the coaching through to the performance department and support staff jumped on board. So you know we're seeing each other every day at work, and then, you know, before work or after work, we're jumping in the boat and knocking out, you know, know, between 10 and 20 kilometers, you know, in a training session. So, you know, really good team building. Great opportunity to have those informal conversations. So, you know, communication was really never an issue. You know, obviously we didn't want to talk about work too much while we were out there. But, you know, those moments, those opportunities to have those conversations because you're spending so much time with each other. So that was really good. So we went over there at the end of the season and stuck into the race. I think we completed in it in close to 6 hours, which was really good. And all the boys, all the guys in the team really, really got behind us. I think they really valued that, you know, we're spending this time with one another outside. We're strengthening those relationships and we're challenging ourselves, you know, because it's to pick something up and to then go, okay, we're going to go into world championships, you know, it's a bit of a lofty feat considering only one of us had ever paddled before. That was our high performance manager, Andrew Gray. A lot of fun, Ron, and something I want to probably have another crack at. You know, I think we can go a little bit quicker next time. You know, it's once it was completed, I just wanted to get back out there and have another crack. So
it's awesome.
Never know what you can expect. And the swell on the day for us, it was quite large, but the Hawaiians were saying it was a small day. So I'd hate to go back there on a few of us got seasick on the boat, but it was good fun.
Well, I think it's so important. I mean, we as coaches, we constantly preach unity and you know, developing communication skills under adversity and those types of things. But very rarely do we do that as coaches or demonstrate that to our athletes. And so I think it speaks volumes to what you guys are doing there. But it also probably scored you more street cred with the athletes than anything you could have done, I would think.
Yeah, our sports science guy John Davey would throw up. We worked out. We'd chuck a GPS on the canoe, so we'd work at our stroke rate. We'd work at our speed. We'd work out what speed we have to maintain to achieve what we want to achieve, and then we'd throw up all the data. And the boys were always interested in the data. We actually started a little Instagram page where we put up all our training highlights, and we'd go out and catch and. The boys were getting right behind it. We had a preseason goal of actually getting all the boys into the boats, but just due to timing, that fell. We can get them into the boats at some stage and give them a taste of what we're going through when we're out there slogging it.
Fantastic.
6 a.m. in the morning before work.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, man, we end the show with a couple resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Best piece, like as I said earlier, I've been lucky to have a heap of mentors in all my roles. I remember a good piece of advice David Boyle gave me when David was head of performance at the Sharks, and that was something along the lines of, you know, your knowledge is only as deep as your network. And I think David instilled in me the importance of being able to reach out to others if you don't know something. You don't have to know it all, but make sure you've got someone in your network that you do know that can help you with that. And David was a big advocate of that, and that's something that stuck with me. So I'm always, you know, making sure, you know, I'm fostering those good relationships. And I've got someone that I can call on and you know, discuss things with outside of the, you know, the great crew that I'm working with now. So that's one great piece of advice. And I think I mentioned it earlier, you know, learn 3 to 4 things about your athlete or your student in this case, because, you know, that's your avenue into the buy-in, into the relationship. And that's something that I mentioned to our interns pretty frequently. And the last one, which I only mentioned to an intern the other day, is learn how to mark out a field with your feet. That's probably, you mark a field out with your feet, Ron. You don't need any sort of measuring device. And, you know, you can go on any field regardless of the markings that are on there, and you can set up your drill. So no real on market. Right. You get some practical advice.
I love it. I love it. Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
Book. Read some really good ones so far this year. Probably my favorite was Endure by Alex Hutchinson, I think. It's a book that really digs into the limits of human performance and looks at the next frontier of human performance under the backdrop of that Nike 2-hour marathon.
Yeah.
Attempt. And it, you know, digs into, you know, Noakes's central governor theory and you know, why we slow down or stop when we're at that that highest level of performance. So that was really interesting. That's something that obviously got me into the profession, the understanding of elite human performance. I really couldn't put that one down, Ron. Another one, I just finished Freakonomics. Maybe a bit late to the party there, but I just loved how, you know, those guys used big data to answer some crazy questions.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, so another one I couldn't put down. And then probably my favorite books by the edgedog.org website. There's a guy called John Brockman. I think John facilitates this website. But what John does is creates a question, or I think he might get an audience poll to create a question, and then has that question and seeks out experts in all different fields. So physics, chemistry, like different types of science fields. It could be politics. It could be religion, whatever it may be, and has them write short essays on that question. And the essays are only, you know, maybe 2 to 3 pages long, but really insightful books. Like some examples of questions that he's posted in the past is, this idea is brilliant. So obviously experts from a variety of different fields are going to give their opinion on what idea they current idea is brilliant. Or, you know, another one was, I think, what should we be afraid of? So obviously, you know, climate change people are going to mention that, and, you know, particle physics guys are going to come up with something completely different.
Right.
And what I like about it, Ron, is it's just short snippets. So I can read 2 or 3, put it down, come back to it in 2 weeks' time, and I haven't missed anything. I don't have to go back and
read
2 or 3 pages prior to, you know, rejog the memory. So I've always got a few of those books around the house.
That was called edge.org. It's put out by edge.org.
Yeah, that's the website, edge.org. And then obviously each book is titled by the posts. Really good books.
I have to check that out. I've never seen those.
Yeah, fine. Pass those on.
Well, man, it's been fantastic. I mean, I go back to, you know, you've done a million great things in your career, but I mean, you'll point back to that teaching as the paramount foundation to what you've done. And I think that's the fundamental task of every strength conditioning coach, is to be a great teacher. And so you're doing that at a high level, and it's just cool to see some of the ways that you're doing that. So I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing, man.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey, on Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.